from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. You may know Carl Hiaasen through his twisted, hilarious novels, Tourist Season, Striptease, Bad Monkey, and many more, unfolding the seedy, whacked-out, occasionally deadly underbelly of life in Florida. But Carl Hiaasen's day job is writing a column for the Miami Herald, weighing in on Florida and the country, politics, environment, gun law, nuttiness, or as Hiaasen puts it, festival of horrors, drill, spill, and kill, pseudo-news, and the joke state. This hour On Point, Carl Hiaasen on Florida and the world. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you read Hiaasen? How do you read Florida? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Fort Pierce, Florida, is best-selling novelist and award-winning columnist Carl Hiaasen. His new collection of columns is Dance of the Reptiles. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Carl Hiaasen, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me back.
You've got no monopoly on nuttiness down there, Carl. Now, don't claim that you do.
No, no, we don't have Chris Christie, but we've got our own.
You do all right. Free associate for us a little bit on a story that's really got our attention this week. Maybe stand your ground thing, maybe not, but shooting in Florida. Trial started yesterday. This is Michael Dunn, Floridian, white guy, charged with first-degree murder. November 2012 shooting of the unarmed 17-year-old Jordan Davis, who was black. Confrontation over loud music. Here's a little tape. Carl, first Coast News, Heather Crawford in Jacksonville in November 2012.
This is the parking lot where Jordan Davis was shot several times as he sat unarmed in the back seat of an SUV, according to police. And as you mentioned, investigators think it all started over the suspect being upset over loud music coming from that SUV.
Eight shots fired, and off the shooter went to check into his, a hotel and have pizza with his girlfriend. Can you give us a little TikTok Hiaasen interpretation of this? A guy pulls in after his son's wedding to a gas station, doesn't like the music.
Shoots into the car. He claims that he saw one of the kids in the car raise a gun, shotgun barrel. Of course, the gun was never found, and he fired, not as you said, multiple times into the car and killed this individual. You know, we're a gun crazy state in Florida, and we have a legislature that decided that you can have guns on campus, college campuses. Now that's a brilliant idea, isn't it? Because there's no drinking or bad behavior going on there. It's illegal in the state to have a backyard gun range as long as you don't fire over a right of way over a road. Apparently, that's the new thing. And then we had also, Tom, this case in Tampa recently of a retired cop who got into an argument over with a fellow who was texting in front of him at the movie theater and shot him dead.
And
he's also apparently going to make a stand your ground claim that he felt threatened because the guy threw some popcorn on him or something. I'm serious, but it's tragic. The fellow who was shot was an Iraq veteran, and he was texting the babysitter. Their little girl was under the weather, and they were texting the babysitter to see.
Good Lord.
The guy just snapped, apparently, and they got into an argument about the texting during the theater, and the solution was to pull a gun and shoot him. Why you would take a gun to a theater, I'm not exactly sure, but this is just the culture, and it's in full bloom here because the NRA has got its hooks into so many of our legislators in Tallahassee that all these crazy laws get passed.
But why Florida as a gun crazy state? I don't think of it as a big hunting or outdoors person state, apart from fishing, yes, but it doesn't exactly seem like a place with lots of guys going off to hunt deer or, the rest.
Oh, they do, though. They have a lot of hunters here, duck hunting, deer hunting. There's still a lot of that going on, but that isn't what we're talking about. These are privately held handguns and even the fella in Big Pine Key who discovered it's perfectly legal to put a gun range in his backyard. One of the reasons he talked about it to the press was he was concerned about how easy it was. He was himself felt the law was a little wacky that allowed you in a residential neighborhood to be firing a gun in your backyard at a target. As the story pointed out, this was just in the Herald a week or so ago, apparently the law, which was passed in 1987, way back then, there's no zoning restrictions, so you could literally if you live next to a daycare center, have your own shooting range in your backyard next to a daycare center. That's what we're dealing with in Tallahassee. That's the kind of those are the kind of knuckleheads that we've got running the state. And then the present legislature is probably worse than the one we had in 87.
Carl Hansen, the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman case put everyone's antenna up on race relations in Florida. And then here again in this Michael Dunn case of the 8 shots into the SUV because he didn't like the loud bass on the hip-hop next to him. I mean, I know those can be very loud, but still, we're talking shooting here.
Yeah,
and you've got a 17-year-old dead boy, Jordan Davis. Well, pick up the race piece of this for a second. Do you have a special problem with race relations in Florida, or could this happen
anywhere?
I don't
think it's unique. Yeah, I think it could happen anywhere. Let's not kid ourselves that Florida has a cornered the market on that. But we've long had, you know, back in the 80s at the Herald, during the 80s, we had at least 3 serious civil disturbances, as we call them, when a white police officer shot black suspects. In one case, the suspect ran from the cops on the motorcycle. He was an insurance guy. He worked for an insurance company, and he was a black fellow named Arthur McDuffie, and he was beaten to death by a group of white Miami police officers who were acquitted of it. And so obviously there was riots, and we've had a struggle with race relations in Florida. It is not because it's a southern state, but because it's a state with a rapidly growing, rapidly urbanizing state where you have this kind of class. It could happen in many, many, many places in this country, and it has.
But explain stand your ground and the whole attitude here. I mean, in this case, in the Michael Dunn case, I guess they're not going with stand your ground. They're going with justifiable use. And I saw CNN reporting Mr. Dunn, this is the shooter, 8 times into the SUV next to him because he didn't like the loud music. 17-year-old boy dead in that SUV. He said he thought he saw a gun coming out there, but there was no gun found. But his former attorney, Robin Lemonidis, said, when all the evidence has been flushed out, I believe it will be extremely clear that Mr. Dunn, the shooter, acted as any responsible firearm owner would have under the same circumstances. What's the attitude embedded in this?
Well, that's what defense lawyers say. That's the kind of thing they're going to say. He's been charged with first-degree murder, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I do think that was the charge, which indicates the prosecutor in Jacksonville, which is a very conservative area of Florida, by the way, felt that the evidence was overwhelming. And they have video from the convenience store and the other witnesses that might suggest there was no real threat. Anybody can imagine a threat. I mean, that's, anybody who fires a gun will then say, I felt threatened. That's just what you say. And even if you screwed up, and even if you fired out of anger or jealousy, rage, whatever, you felt threatened. That's your first line of defense, and that's the first thing defense lawyers are going to say. And it'll be up to a jury to decide whether that's hogwash or not. But you're right, the stand your ground law. And the interesting thing is that—
Is it racial, stand your ground?
I mean,
there was a lot of speculation about that back during the trade when Trayvon Martin was in the spotlight.
Well, I think it's just a knee jerk. I don't think it's racial because I think ironically when that law was passed that the happiest people there were the defense lawyers for a lot of gang members who shoot each other in all kinds of circumstances. And now can say, well, look at this dude. They had a feud going way back. And they try that defense very often now in sort of drug cases, gang cases. People know each other. One feels threatened. And they should. They're both sitting there with guns. So I don't think it's a racial law. I think it's just a stupid law. And the fact is that a judge, before it goes to a jury as a stand your ground case, the judge has to rule it as a valid defense, and it's not adopted in most cases. In most cases, they fall away from that and they go to another defense. And as what they did with Trayvon Martin, that really wasn't his defense. In the end, it wasn't stand your ground; it was self defense. It was I felt threatened, because the stand your ground statute is a little different.
Talk about a gift to a columnist, if you look at it that way. The news this week that George Zimmerman has now signed a contract for a celebrity boxing match with hip-hop artist DMX. I mean, talk about a happy hunting grounds for a columnist. I don't know what's
maybe,
surreal.
Maybe he and the Octomom could box because that would be good. No, you know, the material is so great down here. I mean, let's face
DMX it. DMX telling TMZ he wants to fight on behalf of every black person who's been done wrong in the system. I'm going to beat the living whoop out of him. Well, off you go, Mr. Miami columnist.
Right, yeah, exactly. And Zimmerman is an artist now. He's selling his paintings on eBay to whom I don't know, but I think he sold the first one for over $100,000. So obviously this isn't just Florida. I mean, this is our culture where you turn a tragic event into an occupation. Now you're a full-time celebrity, having been a defendant in a shooting case that drew international attention. A young black guy is dead who shouldn't be dead, who shouldn't have been followed and trailed by George Zimmerman in the first place. He was just walking through an apartment complex unarmed. But you turn that in, you're a celebrity. You get a taste of being on camera all the time. We have cameras in the courtroom in Florida. Many states do. But, you know, the trials are televised, Casey Martin, all those things. So now this is going to be his occupation. It's quite perverse when you think about it. But this is the culture we live in. It's, you know, the Twitter, you know, Facebook. And now he's going to go boxing. That's terrific.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Florida columnist, novelist, humorist Carl Hiaasen about life in the Sunshine State, the United States, now. He's out with a big collection of columns over the last decade and more. It's called Dance of the Reptiles. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. He joins us today from Fort Pierce, Florida. And Carl, a whole range of responses. I mean, here's a people listening into you right now. Gustavo writes to us about Florida. I guess it's a great state if your twisted psyche wants to emulate Dexter or Hannibal Lecter. Oh, I was just protecting myself from Skittles and popcorn. On the other hand, Jared writes to us, despite our image in the popular imagination ranges from Disney fetishism to Florida man Twitter absurdity, Florida's a growing creative hotspot. Orlando, Miami, Gainesville, Tampa, impressive art scenes, top-notch music festivals, film festivals, arts, right on down. Do Floridians feel beaten up on in their Carl Hiaasen representation to the world?
Maybe the Chamber of Commerce does, but people who live here. I mean, we have a sense of that we're all in this together. You won't find a funnier group of people when I do public speaking. If I speak to a group that of Floridians. Mm. All I have to do is say a couple of key words, and they get the joke. They know the story. They get the joke. They laugh because you have to laugh. You'd go crazy if you didn't laugh about it. But Jared is right. I mean, it's also an incredible – there's this incredibly great collision of cultures here because almost so many people who are here are from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And so that's all brought together here. The art scene is great. You have a great music scene. You have all that stuff going on, and you still have an incredibly beautiful place with lots of wilderness worth protecting and fighting for. It's one of the few states you can come where you can, within an hour from Orlando or an hour from Miami, you can be in the middle of a swamp that looks prehistoric and not hear a plane or a boat or a car. And there are not many places like that anymore.
It is amazingly beautiful. You remind us at the same time of its amazing fragility, both environmental and sometimes right between our own ears. Gwen in Portsmouth, Virginia is calling. Gwen, you're on with Carl Hiaasen. What do you know of Florida?
Hello, guys. It is an honor to speak with both of you. And, Carl, I lived in South Florida for over 13 years. Half of that was on my sailboat. And I swear sometimes the air shifts up here in Virginia and I smell Florida again. It is a very particular scent that gets in your blood, and I miss it terribly. But I would like to react to your question. I guess it's a question, maybe unasked. The rudeness of one faction of society drives another faction of society just nuts.
Now, that's really an interesting statement. What that sounds kind of loaded. Rudeness of whom? Here, Gwen, toward and...
Well, I'll give you a fast example. Recently, I was in the car with my kids, and I'm sitting at a stoplight, and for the car in front of me, I guess they rolled their windows down, and out of both windows comes the huge McDonald's bags full of all the little containers, womp, womp, out of both windows. And I, like a dummy, get out, pick them each up, knock on the window, and ask them, wouldn't they like to have this back? And they have to go around the corner to the 7-Eleven and put them in the trash can.
Oh, Gwen, you are an activist. I mean, that's better than pulling out the pistol out of your glove compartment and firing away, I must say.
My four daughters were in line in a McDonald's recently and had been in line. It was a long line. And this group of folks comes in, four of them, and I kid you not, but completely right in front of us, right in the center of the line. And I tapped him on the shoulder. I said, excuse me, do you not see that we were here? And, of course, there were probably a half a dozen people behind us. And I had to get the manager out there.
Hey, Gwen, I have to ask you, are you making a cultural complaint, a complaint about manners? Are you making a racial complaint? Where are we going here, Gwen?
Oh, good question. Because, yes, the races are different. Can we say all of the above? The culture... Crossing the street in the middle of a major thoroughfare when 50 yards up is a stoplight where you can, with a pedestrian crossing, but no, we're better to make the folks going 50 miles an hour have to slow down to keep from hitting you.
Gwen, we've got it. You like a little order and a little well-mannered society, and it doesn't show up where you'd like it or how you'd like it. Carl, what are you hearing that? Your 13-year... co-inhabitant in South Florida and now throwing McDonald's.
I don't know where to start. I mean, my experience of a lifetime, and I think she's talking about things that happened up in where she lives in Portsmouth. Not
seems
just
like
in,
it, yeah.
Not in South Florida, yeah. Just in South Florida, but you're going to encounter rudeness everywhere. My experience is that it cuts across all races and cultures. I mean, there's just bad behavior and there's good behavior. I had the same experience sitting in a convenience store, a van full of tourists from somewhere in the Midwest, I'm guessing. I mean, or up there, you know, I forget where it was a rental car, but mm-hmm. their accents were Midwestern, and they didn't have any hesitation about dumping all their Burger King on right in, just throwing it out the window of the minivan they rented on both sides, and driving off. I was down in the Florida Keys at the time, one of the prettiest places in Florida, and I wish I'd chased them down and done what she had done, although the danger of doing that in Florida is that they'll be
so
looking
wise.
Down the loaded barrel of a gun.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying that the bad behavior, nobody has the market cornered on bad. There's not one group that has the market cornered on bad behavior or good behavior here, and you learn to deal with it. This is a hectic place, Florida. It's a very hectic place to live. It's now over 19 million people.
Third most populous state in the country. I'm just reading
right.
Let's go, edging out
yeah.
New York after California and Texas.
Yeah, and our governor was rooting for us to surpass New York. That's the mentality here. We don't have enough people. We don't have enough traffic jams. The schools aren't yeah. overcrowded enough. Yeah. Let's shoehorn a few more people in here. That would make him happy. But that's the mentality you deal with and you fight against. You want some civility. You have tourists who come down here who love the place, who are here for all the right reasons, and who would never throw, you know, a Q-tip out the window, much less bags and bags of rubbish. Then you have the other kind of folks, and those are the people you want to round down and round up and put in a special facility for a while.
And then you've got this kind of visitor. Well, people may recognize this. CBS Miami's Lauren Pastrana here filing a report on your Florida visitor in Miami Beach recently, Justin Bieber.
Police say the teen idol was speeding, drag racing they called it, in a yellow Lamborghini along Pine Tree Drive. His friend and fellow recording artist Khalil Sharif right behind him in a red Ferrari. CBS 4 News obtained documents from that arrest. Under attitude, the cop concluded Bieber was excited, talkative, using profanity, insulting, and cocky.
Okay, the Justin Bieber's drag racing. Carl Hyson writes about he'd like to have a special prison for tourists. I don't know if Justin qualifies as a tourist.
No, and it's only some kind. We have so many great people coming here, but some tourists deserve just to, you know, just to be, I hate to use the term, you know, just kept away for a while and allowed to sort of ponder their bad behavior. But Justin, you know, we have lots of celebrities who come to Florida, as the one of your correspondents pointed out, who come here. It's a cool place, and especially this time of year. If you look at the temperature up north and you look at the temperature in Miami Beach, you'd have to be insane not to want to be in Miami Beach. You don't have to get in a yellow Lamborghini when you're loaded on Xanax, weed, and a little bit of alcohol, especially at age 19. That's, you know, this is an IQ test, and he failed. That's all that is. And it now looks like he blew into a breathalyzer, and it didn't quite reach the threshold in Florida for alcohol intoxication. And his legions of fans are saying, well, why was he busted? Well, he was on Xanax and weed also.
As he was behind us. Nice enough to point out for the police, I believe.
He was very cooperative in pointing that out. And but, I mean, people come here to implode all the time. I mean, it's just he's one of the more famous ones. But it's this we're a good location for celebrity meltdowns. That's all. Like all other kind of weirdness that happens here a lot.
Let's go to Bob in Clearwater, Florida. Bob, you're on with Carl Hyacin. Thanks for calling, Bob.
Tom, thanks for your show. I look forward to it every day on the radio.
Great.
Carl, I'm trying to remember, were you the gentleman that was interviewed by 60 Minutes by this peculiar behavior of a person from the Miami area who had to get a court order to prevent his continuation of his sexual relationship with his alligator?
Two alligators, yes, sir.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
That's a dance of the reptiles.
It was an intimate relationship. Well, you know, the Herald is a family newspaper. I don't think we got into specifics, but yes, a guy who was caught, he had two alligators. You're not allowed to keep them, by the way, and you're not allowed to keep them in your bed, especially. And it took the state of Florida, the justice system, 2.5 years because he sued to get his alligators back. He didn't just – they took them away, and he sued. He wanted the custody. He had names for them and everything. It took the court system 2.5 years to determine there is no constitutional right in Florida to consorting with protected reptiles. So
what was the highest conclusion on human nature? And I don't know the air in Florida.
I think my conclusion is that in Florida you find love wherever you can get it, and that's where he ended up.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy! Another one we saw recently. You're down in Fort Myers, where your Tea Party Florida Congressman Trey Riddell, with that leave of absence, conviction on cocaine possession. Here's ABC's News Pierre Thomas back in November.
In a statement, the congressman acknowledged the charge, but did not specifically mention cocaine. "I am profoundly sorry," he said. "I struggle with the disease of alcoholism, and this led to an extremely irresponsible choice." Riddell recently supported legislation forcing food stamp recipients to pass a drug test before receiving benefits.
Okay, Carl Hyacin, I don't want to line up a freak show here, but it's just irresistible when we've got a humorist on to get your reaction to these things. What about your good congressman?
Well, first of all, Trey Riddell also is one of the geniuses who voted to shut down the government a couple months ago, costing billions and billions in national productivity. And I don't know whether he was high at the time he voted or whether he was just following his Tea Party roots. But his background is he was a TV anchor. He was very proud. He used to tell people he used to be a stand-up comedian. And I, with the Times, said at least he admits he was a comedian. The others who voted against it won't admit that. But, you know, you don't want to make fun of someone with a drug problem. But I love this defense that, wait a minute, I don't really have a coke problem. It's the booze that makes me go out and buy the coke. This is now the standard. This is the mayor of Toronto. That's his defense.
Yes.
Yeah, I got a drinking problem, and I may have smoked some crack or done some meth, but that's not my real problem. And this is the new line of defense for politicians who are high. So yeah, and he had to. I'm thinking he pretty much had to resign. Trade. Maybe he'll go back to do some more stand up. You know, well, maybe he's got that going for him.
He was in no hurry to resign. He really was dragging his feet on that. Blair in Nashville, Tennessee. Blair, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Carl Hyacin.
Hey Tom. Hey Carl.
Hi.
Hey man.
Carl, I just wanted to mention I'm in Nashville now, but I'm originally from Florida, and I've been enjoying your work for many, many years.
Thank you.
And I now have a son. Well, you're welcome. I now have a son in high school, and I've turned him on to your writing, and I had him do his first book report this year on double whammy. And he got a kick out of it, and I think his teacher did too, especially the part with the dog head on the guy's arm.
Oh, God, yes.
Double whammy. Way back in Carl Hiaasen's fiction writing career. What do you like about Carl Hiaasen's books, Blair?
Well, I'm from Florida. I love hearing about the Mosquito Lagoon in some of his books.
Sure.
And I love his sarcasm, the wit and the humor. Has me rolling on the floor laughing, literally.
Well,
good,
thanks.
Good for you. I don't know what to think of your son's teacher and what she's going to make of getting a book report on
double
whammy.
I was going to say, that's a brave teacher, but I'm very that was a twisted little book, but I was very proud that I was able to get that published. And and it's not often you have a character who has a pit bull attached to his arm for about 104 pages, and it actually was tastefully rendered in that relationship. But I'm very pleased to hear that book. Always when I hear the title, I always smile because I think of that book. Yeah,
the love of Carl Hiaasen being passed from father to son around double whammy.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah,
okay.
great. Paul in Mystic, Connecticut. Paul, you're on with Carl Hiaasen.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What's your story?
My story is a humorous one from South Miami. It starts off sad. My father-in-law passed away about 14 years ago, and he was an amputee.
Okay.
And when my wife and I were settling things at the house, we discovered that he had a number of prosthetics for his leg.
Yeah.
We didn't quite know what to do with them, but I ended up tracking down a vets group that would be happy to take them and repurpose.
Good idea.
But I didn't know South Miami at all. So on a phone conversation, I said to the gentleman, well, let's meet. I know a parking lot. So we both pulled into this parking lot, never met the man before. Two cars pull up next to each other.
Oh, no.
And here we are exchanging limbs from one trunk to another in the car.
This looks bad, Paul. This looks very bad.
It did not look good at all. It didn't occur to either of us until about the third limb was being passed over from one car to the other, and we just stood there laughing at each other.
Oh boy!
Well, that's a great movie scene, actually, isn't it? That would be fantastic.
Yes, look for that in a future Carl Hiaasen novel. I mean, and good on you. I hope some vets got some good use out of those. But there you go again, Carl. South Miami scene, and just on a platter for a columnist or a novelist.
No, you can't beat it. I mean, and this is a good deed being done.
Yes.
That's one of the rare times when two guys are in a parking lot and a good deed. Usually it would be kilos going back and forth between right. The two cars.
A good deed that looks bad. Looks like mafiosa trading body parts or something. But
no, it doesn't.
It's a very good deed. Virginia, Blue Crossing, Michigan. Virginia, you're on with Carl Hiaasen.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Carl.
Hi.
I have never heard of Carl, but I'm going to read him now. My question is, the man that shot Jordan Davis,
yes.
Was he drunk? Because he was coming from a wedding, and I'm a recovering alcoholic, and I know that alcohol has a lot to do with situations like this.
This is the Jacksonville gas station shooting, 8 bullets when he didn't like the volume of the music and was afraid that he might be being attacked, but he had had 2 drinks. Is that drunk, Virginia?
Do we know? Yeah, I mean,
well,
I
don't know. I'm looking
because...
at a news story here that says he'd had 2 drinks but wasn't buzzed. I don't know how they knew that.
Well, how would they? He didn't turn himself in until the next day. So whatever blood alcohol test were done, I mean, I'm guessing the prosecutor would know. But he wasn't arrested. He left the scene. He went to a motel. As you know, with alcohol, each passing hour, it dissipates out of your system. So I'm not sure we're ever going to know what the blood alcohol level was when the gun was fired.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Florida columnist, novelist, humorist Carl Hiaasen about life in the Sunshine State, the United States. Now he writes about all of it from his seat as a columnist at the Miami Herald. He's out with a new collection of columns from that seat. It is Dance of the Reptiles. Carl, they're stacked up for you here. Steve in Lake Placid, New York, you're on the air.
Hi there, Tom.
Hi. What's your story?
Well, I now live in the Adirondacks, so we'll start out by saying that.
Far from Florida, my friend, far.
Yes, well, I lived in Florida for 23 years in the Tampa, St. Petersburg area.
Yeah.
And, well, we've got so many stories, my wife and I, and we've got 8 kids, and with 6 of them still at home, and we could probably fill a book. And one particular story that comes to mind is I was away on business. I was actually up in Lake Placid, and my wife was staying in a house on the Weekiwachee River, which, if you've ever seen, it's a beautiful river, clear, manatees swimming by and all that. And she's seen some canoers going by back and forth and back and forth. So, you know, it'd be great to take the kids on a canoe trip. Well, she takes a little drive, and she's looking for a place where they rent canoes, and she finds a place, and, you know, they negotiate, okay, we're going to go for a 5-mile trip, because you could have went for like a 10-mile trip or 15-mile one.
Okay, yeah.
And so she decides to do a 5-mile trip. So he says, follow me, I'll take you to where I let you off. Well, she follows, you know, just, you know, gets to the river. She says, oh, this river doesn't look quite as nice as the one we were staying on. And the guy didn't say a thing. He unloaded the canoe and off he went. And so my wife and 5 kids, and we had kids from the age of like a year and a half to like 14, okay?
In one canoe?
In one canoe.
Oh.
None of them boaters. I mean, they all had life vests and all that. You had to have those. So they said, okay, let's do this. They get in the canoe, start paddling, you know, and there's houses along the bank of the river, and oh, everything looks pleasant, you know, but the water's dark. You can't see nothing on the bottom or anything. And there's a lady on the shore and her husband, they're like waving, you know, and my wife hears her say, oh, you're brave. And she's like, oh, no, she didn't think anything of it. Well, as they're paddling down the river gets narrower and the trees get darker and the Spanish moss is hanging over the water. And, you know, we've been in Florida for a while. We knew there were alligators and poisonous snakes and all that. But, you know, hey, we're on a canoe trip here, you know, and I'm kind of telling this from my wife's perspective.
Yes, we got it. She and her 5 kids, and you're in alligator country all of a sudden here. Did she? But I guess she got out alive, Steve.
Yeah. Well, you know, they're paddling along, and all of a sudden there's like a 9-foot alligator on the bank of the river. And they're like, ah, you know. And she's like, well, just be calm. She looks back. She sees the youngest child with his hands down in the water, just, you know, calmly just playing in the water. And my 14-year-old daughter's like in a panic, and the rest of the kids are in a panic because they're old enough to realize, okay, there's an alligator. It's big enough to eat us. But then they start paddling in the direction of the alligator. And my wife's going like, no, paddle the other direction.
Steve, I got to hand it to my expert here. You've got more than half your family in a canoe in a, I don't know, it sounds way upriver in Florida with an alligator on the bank. Carl, there you go again. I mean, it just lines up. There's a scene, I don't know, for a book down the road.
Yeah, it's like a Seth Rogen movie all of a sudden, isn't it? I hate to say it, but I mean, alligators don't bother me at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't hate to say it. I like the gator. I would be more concerned if the river is that color, what is in the river. Because certain rivers, especially in the Tampa Bay area and over there, there have been some heavy pollution issues, and there's been phosphate mines, other things dump into some of those rivers. So if you can't see your hand in the river when you put it in, I think the alligators are the least of your worries.
You're a big environmentalist, Carl. How's that battle going? I hate to leave Steve's family out there in the murk, but that's where they are. But how about Florida's battle?
Well, you know, the big story here is the restoration of the Everglades, which is a massive federal and state effort to clean up the Everglades, improve the water flow down into Florida Bay, which would affect, you know, help improve the reefs and the keys and all that kind of stuff. But it's, you know, it's a lot of money. It's a lot of time. And some years are more frustrating. Some years there's no money. And, you know, there's politics involved. So you just, every little victory, every little step, you cheer because it means that somebody's paying attention, which wasn't the case when I was a kid. But overall, there are a lot of areas. The place I live, Tom, up near Fort Pierce here in Vero Beach, the Indian River Lagoon is in an ecological crash right now. Nobody knows why. The seabeds are, grass beds are dying. Manatees have been dying. Dolphins are dying. So all around Florida, there are crises and hot spots that we need to find out why we're killing off our wildlife and our marine life and our oceans and rivers. So it never stops. The battle never stops, to answer your question.
Eyes wide open there. Diane in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Diane, thanks for calling. You're on with Carl Hyacin.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Carl, it's a pleasure to be able to hear your voice and talk to you. I grew up in Plantation.
Oh, boy.
Carl's hometown,
On Camellia Court. Do you remember Camellia Court, a couple blocks over from Holly Lane?
I do. I was on Holly Lane. We were neighbors.
What part of Florida is Plantation in, Carl, Diane? Where is it?
It's west of Fort Lauderdale. Okay. It started as a suburb of Fort Lauderdale,
okay,
really.
Good. So way south. So what do you think, Diane?
Well, first of all, Carl, I just want to say I grew up on boats. My dad worked for Bertram Yachts for 29 years. So I grew up with Jimmy Buffett. I grew up with reading Travis McGee. And then when you and Dave Barry came along, you gave me a perspective on this state that has, I've lived away from there since I was 17. I left when I was 17. But my parents live in Vero Beach, where you live, and so I'm there a lot. And I love that state, but it is a heartbreaking place in terms of the environmental issues, the crazy. And you and Dave Barry have made the crazy and the heartbreaking humorous. And I guess Jimmy Buffett, too, your kind of crew of voices. And how do you do that? I read in the newspaper what's going on environmentally. I hear stories from my brothers still in plantation. And how do you keep that sense of humor?
Well, it's not easy. I think the humor is a way of coping. And I think that lots of folks in Florida feel as you. There is a heartache to seeing things trashed and paved over and to see the damage done, especially if you have kids and grandchildren that you want to experience what you experience. It is heartbreaking. But the humor, satire has a point, and it has a target, and it has an edge to it. And it's about identifying the problem, and you're fighting back by making fun of a situation, and sometimes that helps get you through, and it helps get your readers through the tough times, because there are 19 million souls in this state, and most of them are really good folks who want the best for everybody. And then you have a predator element, you have the greed element, you have all of that other stuff going on that needs to be written about. You just got to take off the gloves and start punching. And you do that sometimes too. But it's all, it's all a form of coping and therapy, psychotherapy.
How has the housing bust worked its way out, or has it worked its way out in Florida? You write in one of your columns in Dance of the Reptiles, without fresh meat for the housing market, Florida basically hasn't got an economy. We saw that come to pass. Where does that stand now, Carl?
Well, the whole, when Jeb Bush was governor, he did make a push for diversifying the economy, because we have tourism and we have the construction industry, and there's a finite amount of land, there's a finite amount of real estate that can be sold, and homes that can be built. I mean, you could still have a robust building industry, but the growth itself can't be the main industry of a state. That's insane. But politicians haven't learned that lesson. They still get a lot of campaign contributions from that sector, and so they're willing to put as much concrete down and build as many high rises as they can cram in. Not all of them, but you drive around and you'll see you'll cross the city line, and all of a sudden you'll see what's going on politically just by what they've done to the landscape.
Is the market back? And if it is that a good thing to you?
Well, yeah, it's back only because the prices went so low. They bottomed out so far. It was so overpriced that now a lot of the vacancies, like in downtown Miami, a lot of the high rises there weren't selling at all. And now that the prices have bottomed out, they're filling up. But that's not new construction in that sense. So it's not like eating up the Everglades, but it is a big drain on the water, which is an issue. A sewage treatment, which is a huge issue in the Miami area. All that stuff that's stress on services, and the infrastructure cannot possibly keep up with the amount of people we have. They can't. So the roads can't, the police can't, services can't, healthcare can't, schools can't. So you have traffic jams, crime, overcrowded schools, all the things that the folks up north thought they were escaping when they moved to Florida, they're here now. It's a very urbanized area.
We hear a lot about Miami buyers from overseas. What do you think of this whole idea, Latin America especially, this idea of Miami as the capital of Latin America? Do you buy that?
Yes. I mean, in terms of financially, the financial interest of Miami, the banking industry and all that stuff is very much rooted in Central South America, the Caribbean, and a lot of the money that's coming in, that pouring into the city, is coming from places like Venezuela, other, where businesses and banks and people move their money to Miami because they feel it's safer. And that money gets loaned out, obviously, and you have more building activity and stuff. And it was the same way in the 80s with the drug money. A lot of the cocaine money was parked in Miami, and to some extent the marijuana, but the big money in the 80s became coke, and it changed the skyline of the city. I mean, just millions, hundreds of millions of dollars landed in that city from the drug trade.
Cocaine skyline. John in Oklahoma City. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I grew up in Sanford, Florida, where all the Trayvon Martin things happened. But when I was 18, I moved down to Miami to try and make it as a musician. And when I hit some hard times, I ended up staying with a large group of Cuban friends, and we had a salsa band. And his neighbors down in Miami did not like him, did not like the music, and they ended up calling and reporting a group of illegal Mexicans living in a house. And we just thought that was so hilarious that someone would do that.
Because they didn't like your salsa music, John. Okay, that's one way to deal with it.
Well, think of the scenario, though. You've got a state that's basically a southern, deep south state. And even though it's populated by folks who've come from all over the country, all over the hemisphere, you still have an element that, to be honest, is not comfortable with diversity, and especially all the big clash and collision of cultures. You have this, you could imagine music and culture coming from Cuba and from South America up and colliding with, the Merle Haggard crowd. It's not always going to be a seamless assimilation. It just isn't. But you work through that stuff. But I know exactly what he's talking about.
I would have thought that would have been worked through by this point. We think of Florida as a state of incredible diversity at this point.
I think that has gotten better, but I do think you're still going to have, because there's so many, this is truly a place you could cut up into three different states. And so the panhandle is extremely different from South Florida. The Central Florida, the I-4 corridor is different from both the panhandle and from Miami-Lauderdale area. So, yeah, it's just, I don't know that it's ever going to go away, Tom. I certainly think people are getting used to one another by now. You'd hope so.
Sure would. Norm in Hinesburg, Vermont. You're on with Carl Hyacin, Norm.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to tell you I enjoy your program.
Thank you.
And I especially have enjoyed Carl's books and his writings. I'm a third-generation Miamian who now has migrated to within an hour of Canada in northern Vermont.
Okay. Voting with your feet.
That's a big move.
Voting with my feet. Yeah, I went back for the first time in 20 years to Miami. I was visiting friends in Fort Myers in Naples. And we drove across the Tamiami Trail, and I was just astounded. My mouth fell open as we left the Everglades National Park area and the watershed area there. You come immediately into a mass of humanity that doesn't stop until you hit the Atlantic Ocean. I was amazed.
Yeah, basically, it's urban sprawl from North Palm Beach County all the way to, the South Dade on the, sort of on your way to the Keys. It's a massive, it's had to be a shock to your system. I mean, when I went away to college in Gainesville, even when I would come back to see my folks in South Florida after, maybe it'd be 4 months or 5 months, between visits or something, I would be floored by how much everything had changed. I mean, how fast it was changing, how utterly uncontrolled the growth was, and just complete insanity. And now we paid the price. We are paying the price, and certainly the Everglades has paid the ultimate price.
Where's it go? Look at with us for a second at Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio and.
Yeah,
Florida as a breeding ground. I mean, we've got John Boehner recently telling Jay Leno that he favors Jeb Bush in 2016. Have you got yet another Bush in your quiver down there for the presidential games?
I think this is the first time I've ever heard Jeb start making sounds like he might run. And in the past, he's been vehement about it. And I know
despite his mama saying no more Bushes.
Right. In the family, there were family issues. He very much wanted to spend time with his family after being governor for 8 years. And I didn't think he would ever run. But I think there may be a point now where he's looking at the field, looking at the bench and going, you got to be kidding me. Ted Cruz. You got to be, who can possibly be serious about this? Because they have, They can't carry Florida with the group they've got. Now, Marco Rubio would get annihilated by Hillary Clinton in Florida. Jeb would not. It would be very close because he left as a popular governor. He left with the support of, you know, Democrats outnumber Republicans in Florida, registered voters. And Jeb won two terms because of he had a tremendous crossover vote, and he could do it again. So he looks attractive, I think, to moderate Republicans, and there are millions of them out there who are frustrated right now. And he is a smart guy. He is conservative, but he's not a drooler. And he's not, he's got a much heavier resume than Marco Rubio does, to be honest with you.
What makes you think he's paying attention again, Carl? What makes you think he might be?
Well, I've seen various statements and appearances where he's asked, are you going to run? Are you going to run? And things like Boehner saying that. I don't think it's an accident that Boehner just said that. I think somebody's putting out the feelers and signals that he might be interested. I'm just based on what I've read. I could be dead wrong, but... But he'd have the best chance of winning Florida of any of the candidates, that's for sure.
Well, he's a long way from a Tea Party guy, the GOP with a lot to sort out there. Carl Hiaasen sorts out all kinds of angles of human life in Florida and well beyond in his wonderful new collection of columns, Dance of the Reptiles. Carl, it's always great to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us.
And thanks for having me back, Tom.
Hey, we love Florida and wish it well. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.